Welcome to Food for Thought. My name is Colleen Patrick-Gaudreau from Compassionate Cooks. I founded Compassionate Cooks to empower people to make informed food choices and to debunk myths about vegetarianism and animal rights. You can learn more about who we are and what we do by visiting our website, www.compassionatecooks.com. Hi, everybody. Welcome to today's podcast. I have a bit of a cold, so unfortunately, it will be forever memorialized on this podcast episode, and I hope I don't sound too ridiculous, so hopefully that won't distract you from hearing today's message. So I hope you're all doing well. Today's sponsor is Roseanne Marulli. Roseanne sponsored the podcast and replied to my thank you with, guess what? A really lovely email. She thanked me for doing the podcast and she wrote, "What you're doing is incredibly inspiring. The thing that's been the hardest thing for me since I became vegan a year ago, after being vegetarian for about 3 years, has been finding the middle ground between downplaying my responses to people to avoid preaching at them or making them feel bad, and taking the bait from hostile people who are obviously interested in only one thing, arguing. Your podcasts present thoughtful, articulate responses to the questions and pseudo questions that we hear all the time, but it's the tone of your answers that sets you apart. The fact that there's no defensiveness or animosity in them is as powerful, if not more so, than the responses themselves." Thanks for that. Thank you, Roseanne. I know it's not always easy to find that middle ground, but I do think it's essential, obviously. Finding the middle ground between speaking the truth, speaking for animals, and not getting all riled up can be difficult, but as I've said before, when you encounter hostile people or hostile responses, try not to take it personally. Try to keep a sense of humor. Try to find common ground. Try to engage in a dialogue by asking questions. We don't always have to have all the answers. We can ask questions. And the answers to these questions might help you understand how to respond. And those questions that you ask might actually get that person thinking themselves. So just do your best, Roseanne. Remember that you are human. Remember you're not perfect. Thank God we're not perfect. Life would be pretty boring if we were all perfect little creatures. So thank you. Thank you, Roseanne. Thank you very much for your podcast sponsorship. I'd also love to share with you another email I received recently from a woman in Canada. Her email, as you'll see, or hear rather, is so honest and so humble and just so beautiful that I had to share it with you. She also shares some personal aspects of her life, which I wanted to respect. So I'm choosing not to use her name. I hope she doesn't mind. I think she'll understand. But here's what she wrote. "In the past 3 weeks, I have listened to every one of your podcasts. And for the last 3 weeks, I have not eaten animals or anything that happens to come out of their bodies. It sounds silly, a podcast changing someone, but that's exactly what your podcast has done. I never would have thought of myself as someone who would ever, quote, go vegan. I was always the vegetarian who said, 'I don't eat meat, but don't worry,' insert shocked, annoyed parent or friend. I would never not eat dairy or eggs. And now I don't. I was always frustrated by vegetarians who would try to guilt or pressure people into not eating meat, not because what they were saying was wrong, but because it was so slanted and angry that I knew they were only digging themselves a deeper hole. But you present the information in such a logical manner that even though just a few hours before listening to the first of many of your podcasts, I had stocked my fridge full of eggs, milk, and cheese, when I returned home, enlightened, I could not touch them. The wake-up call for me, the one fact that did it, was that the veal industry is a direct result of the dairy industry. Duh. It never even occurred to me. I would comment on my dad munching away on his baby cow while I proudly ate my fettuccine Alfredo, not even thinking that the food on his plate was only there because of the food on my plate. I might as well have been eating the veal. In 8th grade, I became vegetarian. This was quite a shock to my father, having been born on a small farm in Quebec, Canada, and was a 6th-generation butcher. Though I did this for ethical and environmental reasons, there was a darker motivation driving me. Over the year, I had developed an eating disorder and used my vegetarianism as an excuse to avoid food. Thankfully, my two beautiful friends saw the destructive path I was on and sought out help for me. A mentor of mine who had faced the same struggles as I did told me to find passions in my life and celebrate them. She said, "Find parts of you that you are truly proud of." As I slowly began to accept and love myself for the first time in my life, vegetarianism, which was once a means of hiding my anorexia, became one of the parts of myself that I was proud of. I embraced it and it helped me heal. It showed me that the compassion I had toward the animals I was sparing by not eating them could also be directed toward myself, self-compassion. Today, I truly am proud of who I am. There is a wholeness to me now. That's the best way I can describe it. I feel at peace and energized and complete. When I was a vegetarian, I would state why I didn't eat meat. But even as I did, I couldn't help but feel a bit hypocritical. I wouldn't eat this and this and this, but this, eggs or milk or cheese, was okay. You said it perfectly. My actions are now a direct reflection of my morals and values. Seriously, thank you, Colleen. I can't imagine the dulled state of mind I would be in if it was not for you and your message. Continue. Persist. No matter what. You are changing the world. Through people, you are saving the lives of animals that need not be slaughtered. Thank you. Sincerely and with immense gratitude. So thank you for letting me share that with you. I think you could probably see why I did. Thank you to all of you listeners, all of you subscribers, all of you sponsors like Roseanne. If you would like to support this podcast, please consider a one-time or monthly contribution. Just visit compassionatecooks.com and click on support our podcast. I'm very grateful for your support and for your emails. So welcome to Food for Thought. As regular listeners know, the structure for today's episode is such that I read an essay or a story or an article from someone else, someone other than myself. And today I'd like to read you an excerpt from a very special book that I cannot recommend highly enough. It's called The World Peace Diet, and it's written by Will Tuttle. T-U-T-T-L-E, Will Tuttle. Will is just an absolutely amazing person. He uses his compassion and his wisdom in order to create that world that we all envision, a world of peace and kindness and nonviolence and high consciousness. He is a gifted writer and he lectures all around the country. He's really an amazing spirit. The full title of his book is The World Peace Diet, Eating for Spiritual Health and Social Harmony. And I'm so honored to call him a colleague and a friend. I don't think there are many people doing the kind of work that Will's doing, using universal principles to raise awareness and raise consciousness at the same time. We are very similar in our use of language, in our perception of things, and in our approach. And if you appreciate this podcast, I am certain you would love his book, which you can buy through my store at compassionatecooks.com. You can also visit willtuttle.com, willtuttle.com. He just recently wrote to me and told me that someone told him that they heard his book mentioned on the Howard Stern Show, of all places. Apparently, Howard Stern's co-host, Robin, read The World Peace Diet and she became vegan. And so she was recommending the book to all of her listeners. See what I mean about finding seeds in the unlikeliest of places? You just absolutely never know. So I'd like to read you an excerpt from Will's book. And I chose a section that enables me to talk about another book I highly recommend. And that's Jim Mason's An Unnatural Order, which is also on my website, and which I know I've recommended before. By the way, both of these books are published by Lantern Books, a wonderful New York-based publishing house founded by Martin Rowe. Martin Rowe was the co-founder of Satya Magazine, which unfortunately has since closed its doors, but luckily you can still access all of the past articles and issues on their website. Lantern Books publishes books for, and I'm quoting from their website, for all who want to live with greater spiritual depth and commitment to the preservation of the natural world. And they focus on books about animal advocacy, vegetarianism, health and healing, environment, social justice, and a lot more. It's run by fantastic people. So check them out at lanternbooks.com and do support their work and do support the books that they publish. So Will refers to Jim Mason's book in this excerpt that I'm going to read, and it's definitely one of the books that helped shape my thoughts about animal rights. To give you an idea of what his book is about, what Jim Mason's book is about, this is what Publishers Weekly says about the book. It's an eloquent, important plea for a total rethinking of our relationship to the animal world. Mason analyzes the West's dominionist worldview, which exalts humans as overlords and owners of other life. His powerfully argued manifesto will change many readers' attitudes toward hamburgers, animal experimentation, hunting, and circuses. So I just wanted to recommend that book as well, and you'll get a taste of it from the excerpt I'm about to read. So without further ado, here is an excerpt from Will Tuttle's book, The World Peace Diet, from the chapter titled Our Culture's Roots, pages 17 to 24. Most of us don't think of our culture as being a herding culture. Looking around, we see mainly cars, roads, suburbs, cities, and factories. And while there are enormous fields of grain and cattle grazing in the countryside, we may not realize that almost all of the grain is grown as livestock feed, and that most of the untold billions of birds, mammals, and fish we consume are confined out of sight in enormous concentration camps called factory farms. Though it is not as obvious to us today as it was to our forebears a few thousand years ago, our culture is, like theirs, essentially a herding culture, organized around owning and commodifying animals and eating them. It was roughly 10,000 years ago that wandering tribes in the Kurdish hill country of northeastern Iraq began domesticating sheep and initiated a revolution with enormous consequences. Anthropologists believe it was an outgrowth of the hunting practices of these tribes who began attaching themselves to particular herds of wild sheep, culling them, and increasingly controlling their mobility, food, and reproductive lives. They eventually learned to castrate and kill off male sheep so that the herd consisted primarily of females with a few rams. From this, they learned selective breeding to create animals with more desirable characteristics. Goats were apparently domesticated soon after sheep, followed by cattle 2,000 years later to the west and north, and subsequently by horses and camels another 2,000 to 4,000 years after that. Highly charged concepts of property ownership and of male bloodlines and bloodline purity gradually emerged, of which there is ample evidence by the time the historical period began about 4,000 years ago. Our Western culture can be seen as having two main roots, ancient Greece and the ancient Levant, the Eastern Mediterranean Basin and Middle East. Reading the earliest extant writings from these cultures from about 3,000 years ago, like Homer's Iliad and Odyssey and the Old Testament accounts of the ancient kings and their wars, we find that these cultures were oriented around meat-eating, herding, slavery, violent conquest, male supremacy, and offering animal sacrifices to their mostly male gods. For the old herding cultures, confined animals were not just food. They were also wealth, security, and power. The first money and form of capital were sheep, goats, and cattle, for only they were consumable property with tangible worth. In fact, our word capital derives from capita, Latin for head, as in head of cattle and sheep. The first capitalists were the herders who fought each other for land and capital and created the first kingdoms, complete with slavery, regular warfare, and power concentrated in the hands of a wealthy cattle-owning elite. Our word pecuniary comes from the Latin word picus, meaning cattle, and the ancient Roman coin, the denarius, was so named because it was worth 10 asses. Livestock in the ancient herding cultures thus defined the value of gold and silver. Food animals were the fundamental standard of wealth and power. This fact gives us insight into the political might of the ranching and dairy industries that continues to this day. By commodifying and enslaving large, powerful animals, the ancient progenitors of Western culture established a basic mythos and worldview that still lives today at the heart of our culture. Ryan Eisler's The Chalice and the Blade and Jim Mason's An Unnatural Order summarize and digest the work of historians and anthropologists, providing some interesting perspectives on the fundamental value shifts that occurred when humans began dominating large animals for food and how these changes affect us in the present day. It's important to note here that the study and interpretation of history is notoriously subjective. We can notice in our own individual lives that our experience and understanding of our past changes as we change. This is obviously also true of the vast and complex collective past generated by millions of people. When we move into trying to understand prehistory, cultural pasts before written records, it becomes even more subjective. As historian Cynthia Eller writes, prehistory is still a huge and largely blank canvas. Thus, incredibly diverse scenarios can be painted upon it, depending on the predilections of individual thinkers. Ryan Eisler draws on the work of many anthropologists and writers, particularly Marija Gimbutas, Jacquetta Hawkes, and Merlin Stone, to argue that there have been basically two types of societies, which she refers to as partnership and dominator. In partnership societies, men and women are essentially equal and work together cooperatively, and Eisler attempts to demonstrate that this was the norm for many tens of thousands of years of human life prior to the expansion of patriarchal dominator cultures that were based on herding animals. This relatively recent occurrence, 5,000 to 7,000 years ago, was due to what Gumbutas calls the Kurgan invasions by warlike herders from Central Asia into Eastern Europe and the Mediterranean basin. Bringing a culture in which men viewed women as chattel, and by the way, just an aside that I know Will would appreciate, the word chattel, which is basically the definition of chattel, is an article of movable property, like slaves, and these slaves can be human or animal slaves, and the word chattel and cattle and capital all come from the same root word. So bringing a culture in which men viewed women as chattel, they apparently came in three waves over roughly 2,000 years, violently attacking, destroying, and fundamentally changing the older, more peaceful partnership societies. According to Eisler, Gumbutas, and others, these older cultures tended to eat forage and gardened foods, worship fertility goddesses, make communities in fertile valleys, use metals to make bowls rather than weapons, and did not engage in war. The invading dominator cultures herded animals and ate mainly animal flesh and milk, worshipped fierce male sky gods like Enlil, Zeus, and Yahweh, settled on hilltops and fortified them, used metals to make weapons, and were constantly competing and warring. Violent conflict, competition, oppression of women, and class strife, according to Eisler, need not characterize human nature, but are relatively recent products of social pressure and conditioning brought by the invading herding cultures whose dominator values we have inherited. Where did these invading patriarchal cultures come from, and what made them that way? In a later book, Sacred Pleasure, Eisler cites the research of geographer James DeMeo, who ascribes the expansionist migrations of the Kurgan invaders and other herders to harsh climactic changes that, quote, set off a complex sequence of events, famine, social chaos, land abandonment, and mass migration, that eventually led to a fundamental shift, end quote, in human cultural evolution. Herding livestock, Eisler points out, tends to lead to aridity, dryness, aridity, and to produce a vicious cycle of environmental depletion and increasing economic competition for even more scarce grazing grounds, and thus a tendency for violent contest over territorial boundaries. She adds that the practice of herding animals produces the psychological hardening characteristic of dominator cultures, and this is a quote, this is an excerpt from Eisler's book. Pastoralism relies on what is basically the enslavement of living beings, beings that will be exploited for the products they produce and that will eventually be killed. This would also help explain the psychological armoring or deadening of soft emotions that DeMeo believes characterize the origins of dominator societies. Moreover, once one is habituated to living off enslaved animals, for meat, cheese, milk, hides, and so forth, as practically the sole source of survival, one can more easily become habituated to view the enslavement of other human beings as acceptable. Whether there actually were earlier cultures that were more peaceful, partnership-oriented, and egalitarian, as Eisler and many others assert, and whether violent conflict, males, and competition have always dominated human socio-economic cultural structures, is still a hotly contested issue among academics. What seems undeniable, though, is the effect on human consciousness of commodifying and enslaving large animals for food. Jim Mason takes Eisler's work farther in this regard, developing some more historical and psychological connections between domination of animals and domination of other people. He points out that the agricultural revolution introduced profound changes into the ancient forager cultures, transforming their relationship with nature from one of immersion to one of separating from and attempting to control her. Out of the separation, two types of agriculture emerged, plant and animal, and the distinction between them is significant. Growing plants and gardening is more feminine work. Plants are tended and nurtured, and as we work with the cycles of nature, we are part of a process that enhances and amplifies life. It is life-affirming and humble work that supports our place in the web of life. On the other hand, large animal agriculture, or husbandry, was always men's work and required violent force from the beginning. to contain powerful animals, to control them, guard them, castrate them, and in the end, kill them. Mason also emphasizes the important influence that animals seem to have in human psychological development and health, as well as the violent psychosocial characteristics researchers find in observing cultures around the world that herd large animals. Citing anthropologists Paul Shepard and Anthony Leeds, he notes that Shepard, quote, ticks off the mainstays of herder cultures the world over. Aggressive hostility to outsiders, the armed family, feuding and raiding in a male-centered hierarchical organization, the substitution of war for hunting, elaborate arts of sacrifice, monomaniacal pride and suspicion. Mason points out the similarities in these respects among desert tribes of the Middle East, Chukchi reindeer herders of eastern Siberia who, quote, love to boast of, quote, feats of strength, acts of prowess, violent and heroic behavior, excessive endurance and expenditure of energy, and our American cowboy rodeo culture. Building on the work of Eisler, Mason, and others, we can see that the culture we live in today is a modern continuation of the herding culture that arose in the Middle East and Eastern Mediterranean Basin, and that the central defining belief of this culture is still the same. Animals are commodities to be owned, used, and eaten. By extension, nature, land, resources, and people are also seen as commodities to be owned, used, and exploited. While this seems logical to us today as modern inhabitants of a herding and animal-consuming capitalist culture, this is a view with enormous consequences. The commodification of animals marked the last real revolution in our culture, completely redefining human relations with animals, nature, the divine, and each other. In the old herding cultures, animals were gradually transformed from mysterious and fascinating cohabitants of a shared world to mere property objects to be used, sold, traded, confined, and killed. No longer wild and free, they were treated with increasing disrespect and violence, and eventually became contemptible and inferior in the eyes of the emerging culture's herders. Wild animals began to be seen merely as potential threats to the livestock capital. Likewise, other human beings, too, began to be seen as threats to livestock or as potential targets for raiding if they owned animals. Battling others to acquire their cattle and sheep was the primary capital acquisition strategy. The ancient Aryan Sanskrit word for war, which is gavya, means literally the desire for more cattle. It appears that war, herding animals, oppression of the feminine, capitalism, and the desire for more capital, livestock, have been linked since their ancient birth in the commodification of large animals. The larger and more powerful the animals that were herded, the more fierce, cruel, and violent the cultures had to be to successfully dominate them and protect them from marauding wild animals and people. The largest animals were cattle and horses, and the cattle herding cultures that established themselves in the Middle East and Eastern Mediterranean engaged in unimaginably vicious warfare with each other and against weaker people for millennia, gradually and forcibly spreading their culture and herding values throughout Europe and most of Asia. From Europe, the same cattle culture eventually spread to the Americas. It continues to spread to this day through transnational corporations like ConAgra, Cargill, Smithfield, and McDonald's, as well as through projects sponsored by the World Bank and the UN, religious missionaries, and charities that propagate animal slavery like the Heifer Project. At the living core of this ancient culture that became what we call today Western civilization was the absolute supremacy of humans over animals, reinforced through daily meals. Wealth and prestige for men began to be measured in terms of how many livestock animals were owned and how large an area of land was controlled for grazing. The role model for young boys became that of the successful proto-capitalist, the macho herder and warrior, tough, cool, emotionally distant, and capable of unflinching violence. Women, livestock, and captured or conquered people were property objects contributing to the total amount of capital. Wars, though horrific to combatants and the general population, were potent methods used by the wealthy aristocracy to increase its accumulation of cattle, capital, land, power, and prestige. It's helpful to realize that the mentality of domination characterizing the culture into which we were born thrives on seeing and emphasizing differences and ignoring similarities, because this is what enslaving and killing animals requires us all to practice. As herders and dominators of animals, we must continually practice seeing ourselves as separate and different from them, as superior and special. Our natural human compassion can be repressed by learning to exclude others and to see them as essentially unlike us. This exclusivism is necessary to racism, elitism, and war, because in order to harm and dominate other people, we must break the bonds that our hearts naturally feel with them. The mentality of domination is necessarily a mentality of exclusion. It's obvious if we look closely that many of the root assumptions and activities of the ancient herding cultures still define our culture today. The single most defining activity of these ancient cultures was, as it is today, feasting regularly on foods provided by the bodies of dominated and excluded animals. Wars still enrich a wealthy elite class while millions bear the burden of them, and the world's rich feed on animals fattened on grain and fish while the poor go hungry. Our capitalistic economic system and its supporting political, legal, and educational institutions still legitimize our commodification and exploitation of animals, nature, and people, our domination of the underprivileged and foreign, and an unequal and unjust distribution of goods based on predation, often euphemized as competition and free trade, oppression, and war. As we have evolved socially, we have made some undeniable gains in reducing certain excesses and in providing some protection to the weak and vulnerable. On the whole, however, we have to wonder why our progress has been so slow and difficult. The answer to this is on our plates, and extends from there to feedlots, slaughterhouses, research laboratories, rodeos, circuses, racetracks, and zoos, to hunting, fishing, and trapping activities, and to prisons, ghettos, wars, and the military-industrial complex, and our ongoing rape and destruction of the living world. Speaking of raping the natural world, whenever I hear non-vegetarians talk about how much they care about nature and the environment, how much they care about the ecosystem, and how much they care about wildlife and wild animals, I wonder if they're aware of the USDA's Wildlife Services Program. It used to be called Animal Damage Control, but for public relations purposes, it was changed to the much gentler, much more euphemistic name of Wildlife Services, which is such a slap in the face to wildlife, because this name sounds like it's actually providing services for them, but it's actually quite the opposite. Wildlife Services uses millions of taxpayer dollars to kill hundreds of thousands of wild animals annually. In the fiscal year 2000, the USDA spent $31.9 million, $13 million of which was from federal funding, to protect ranchers, to protect livestock. Let me just give you an idea of how many animals are killed every year to protect the cattle, to protect the capital of ranchers. The numbers keep going up, but this is just an example. This is a snapshot from 2004 when Wildlife Services killed 2.7 million wild animals. And here's how it breaks down. 75,674 coyotes, 32,085 beavers, 10,518 raccoons, 11,484 pigs, feral pigs, 9,797 snakes, 6,773 skunks, 5,574 squirrels, 3,907 foxes, 2,841 deer, 2,210 prairie dogs, and 4,748 rats. Say what you will about rats or skunks, but they have a right to live as much as any of the other animals we're taught to admire. And you can see these numbers for yourself. Just type in USDA Wildlife Services. You know, we've been taught to compartmentalize animals into those we eat and those who entertain us and those whose fur we desire and those we keep in our homes and those we feed outside with our bird feeders. And this social framework has divided up animals so that we can justify exploiting some, but admire others and love others. Since 1885, the U.S. federal government has been involved in wildlife killing campaigns designed to protect ranchers. They kill millions of coyotes and wolves and bears and mountain lions and birds and many animals as a subsidy for the livestock industry. The methods they use are ineffective, they're cruel, and they're environmentally destructive. And the ones who benefit most are the ranchers, the herders, who are under no obligation to change their livestock management practices to reduce predator conflicts. The animals are shot, they're poisoned, they're gassed, they're snared, and they're caught in leg hold traps, and they suffer tremendously. Birds are no luckier, again, to protect the agriculture industry. And again, remember, much of the grain and crops grown are for livestock. They're not for direct human consumption. Our tax dollars also go to killing millions of birds. And here's the breakdown from 2004. This just sounds so unbelievable. 2,320,086 starlings, 76,874 pigeons and doves, 22,204 crows, ravens and blackbirds, 15,508 sparrows, 10,806 geese and swans, 6,279 finches, 3,703 vultures, 3,122 egrets, and thousands more. I have watched birds shot in the sky and fall down. Sometimes they're dead immediately. Sometimes they're suffering immensely. It's a heartbreaking, violent sight, and nobody would tolerate it if we saw it for ourselves. But hidden away with misleading, dishonest program names such as Wildlife Services, we don't know that it exists. We don't see these relationships, and I realize that most of us don't know about this. But once we know, once we understand this, we have to understand that we can stop this by changing our habits. Most people would never think of herding the mourning doves they watch from their windows, or the geese they feed at the park, or the coyotes they catch sight of in the wild. Yet because of our social and personal dietary habits, millions of these animals are unnecessarily killed each year. And on behalf of these millions, the indirect victims of our appetites, and on behalf of the billions of animals who are the direct victims of our appetites, this is Colleen with Compassionate Cooks. Thank you for listening.